It's always the interesting part about Bereishis is, or the story that we have, the last few parshas all begin with the Mechiras Yosef, which is the cause of much of our problems in Yiddishkeit, because depending on the track that you take, which is always what we discussed, you know, you have different mindsets from the time you're growing up, that the brothers are doing something terrible, or did Yosef deserve what happened, what Yaakov did he deserve what happened? And basically we see certain things that start from, that are passed down from generation. We say so many times, myself a similar bonim, but it's more than that. I don't know if you, what caught my eye was in the Science Times this week, they had they wrote an article on what they call epigenetics. I don't know if anybody read it, but it was a very interesting topic, which sort of seemed to indicate a lot of things that we go on, and maybe that has to do with myself a similar bonum, not just that you follow in the footsteps of your father, how we reacted, but they're discussing the idea that certain things happen in somebody's life. It's not necessarily because your father is a role model and you learn from what he did, but if your father goes through certain situations, your parents go through certain tragedies, certain occurrences, that it actually has an effect on your genes, that it makes you do certain things not because it's a role model, but because it's in your genes, just like somebody who's an alcoholic, possibly, and they mentioned that in particular, about a woman who's an alcoholic while she's pregnant. So it has to do, first of all, you have to understand it's not somebody who grows up and the father goes through the tragedy after the child is born. It's the parents, for instance, and they, even though they mention other things first, and then they finally get into children of Holocaust survivors who after the war, is their life centered around or caused by the fact that their parents were Holocaust survivors and they grow up with certain values and proclivities to act certain ways? Or is it really the gene pool has an effect and changes? Just like you inherited genes, you inherit genes to be, and the statistics, even though there's a big argument in science, there are a lot of people that go forget it because it seems to, if you're going to say what they say, it seems to deflect responsibility for a lot of actions, but they said the statistics bear out very much so that children of parents who went through horrific things and various tragedies in their life have a shorter lifespan. And that was what they say. Generally speaking, children of Holocaust survivors, by and large, the lifespan is short.
But who says that's genetic?
But that's what they... You're right. No, there's a big argument. This is a school of thought that they're working on, and that's what they're calling epigenetics. But the fact is, there's a lot of scientists that say, forget it. It can't be true. You're right. There's a lot of scientists who disagree. They made a point of saying it. But but you can't go beyond a certain amount of statistics that so say it. So what I wanted to say was...
Epi means
yeah.
Prefix.
Right.
Prefix means
on top
yeah,
of.
Super
right.
The epicenter.
So that's what they're focusing on, and they're trying to do various studies on statistics. That's how they base certain things. There's a major argument. Does it, you know, is it mice of a similar bonum, or is it really the way it is in reality? So you could say basically that why in some respects does... No, I'm not arguing. I'm not going to push that issue.
Correlation is not causation.
I'm just saying is a school of thought. I don't agree with it in a lot of ways myself, obviously. I'm not trying... The biggest problem is it's like you want to say the devil made me do it. And that doesn't work out. But my point is over here is we get to this... We get to Vayechi, and Vayechi begins very simply with Yaakov giving the blessing to calling Yosef, Hinei Avicha Choleh, and he starts to give Yosef a blessing, actually, and he give Ephraim and Manasseh. Interestingly enough, the Abarbanel makes a very, which I just read it right now, but what it says very interestingly enough, which bears out very interestingly enough, because if you don't give it any thought, what was the reason at this point in time, and it has to do with Mechiras Yosef, Yaakov did learn his lesson to a point. And as we know, when he says, Sikeles Yodov, Ki Menashe Abchor, when Yosef chides his father and says, what are you doing? You know, you messed up your children, don't mess up my children in the same way. But the Abarbanel makes a point of saying, Yosef felt that way, but Yaakov understood what would happen here, because what is the problem now at this juncture? He's giving a blessing to Ephraim and Menashe. Does he give a blessing to his other grandchildren? Do you see it in the Chumash that he gives a bracha separate to the children of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, and so on and so forth? No, he blessed his other children, but only Menashe and Ephraim get a special blessing as the children of Yosef. And therefore, he says, he called them separately and gave the blessing to Yosef's children privately, not as he does later to all the children. He kafsu v'shimu b'nei Yisrael Yaakov v'shimu el Yisrael avichem, when he gathered them all together to give his final goodbye speech, so to speak. And he gave it to Menashe and Ephraim privately because he didn't want to incur the jealousy once again of the other grandchildren, because he saw that this could be a problem. So he did Yosef and his children very privately, and then he gathered all the Shvatim together, which is an interesting thought process.
But maybe they needed a special bracha because they grew up in Egypt.
No, that's certainly a screw. That's why when we say Yivarech Hashem, when you say, you know, that the Kiruvim v'Shimon, we give that bracha Kefraim and Menashe, that we say that bracha to our children because here we are living in Golus. And so therefore we mention Ephraim and Menashe rather than the other ones who grew up in Eretz Israel. That's certainly the way we look at things, and that's why we single out Ephraim and Menashe. But the fact is over here, what the Abarbanel makes another point of saying right away was, obviously he's of the tack, he's of the opinion that Yaakov knew already all about Mechiras Yosef. Difference of opinion of if he knew and when he knew and what he did about it or whatever it is. But he understood that. The brothers, he knew if he was going to call the brothers and tell them all, I want to talk to you, then they're going to be a little leery of all gathering around, because all they're going to have in their mind is, Daddy wants to give us the tongue lashing. He's going to scream at us and yell at us and tell us all the things, which is what we see happens initially. And he needs to give them a tease to get them all to come. And which is why the Lashon is very interesting when it starts off and says, He kavtsu v'shimu b'nei Yaakov v'shimu el Yisrael avichem. And he says, Eisa sheh yikra eschem yachris hayomim. How is he going to get them to hang around and say, we don't need to hear it from Daddy all over again. He's been yelling at us for years, and I need them to come and listen now. How could I begin the speech by getting them to gather around? What am I going to say? He says, gather around, everybody. I want to tell you what's going to happen in the future. Now everybody is gathering around, this is going to be interesting. So this is something that everybody wants to hear. Now, when he gathers them all around, he says, "V'shimu el Yisrael avichem." Now he gathered around. I'm not going to talk about the future. What I really wanted to just get you to come, now that you're all here, listen to what your father has to tell you. Because what does it say? I'm not just coming to give you a speech like the principal of a school or your Rebbe. Listen to your father. He uses the v'shimu, and listen to me. Why say v'shimu el Yaakov avichem? Because listen to your father. I'm your father, and I have your best interest at heart. And so I need you to listen to what I have to say. And then he goes on, is seemingly at the beginning of a tirade in a way, and he tells Reuven, this is what you did to cause your downfall, your problems, Yes, it's Esvi, you know, Pachas Kamayim Al Tosaki, Elisa Mishkevei Avicha, Shimon and Levi. Yeah, but in general, the idea is that he's giving them Tochacha, Shimon and Levi, the same thing. And then, of course, as I remember always, I guess it's more than one parish that says, Yehuda Atoyaducha Achecha, because what's happening at this point after he's giving the riot act to Reuven, Shimon and Levi, the other brothers begin to say, We're leaving. So how does it begin the next bracha? Yehuda, he has to call them because they're getting up to leave. And they don't want to hear. He's figuring they're all going to do it. So he says, Yehuda, come back here. Atah yoducha achecha. To you already, it's another thing. You have the ear of your brothers. You have the ability to have that effect. And we see what was the whole scenario of Yehuda, because as a lot of people asked, all the brothers were complicit in the Mechiras Yosef, but Yehuda was the only one who really took responsibility for his actions in his life. He was always the one who said, yes, I did wrong. And that's what we see with David HaMelech. You know, Chatasi, Yehuda was saying, you know, I'm a sinner. I did the wrong thing. Vayom etzot kami meni. He was the one who was willing to take responsibility, which is where we're going. So what am I getting back to over here? The Mechiras Yosef is a very interesting thought process because we see the growth between Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And when I started the whole conversation with epigenetics, but not to harp on that's what I believe, but just to say that how things morph out into future things the way it happened. Avraham was this person who lived his life with seemingly no fear. He just did whatever he thought was right. When Lot was taken captive, he gathers together an army. Does he go to negotiate with the kings and say, you know, you took my cousin, let's sit down and talk about it?
No negotiating.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. I mean, that's the way Yaakov lived his life, but not everybody subscribes to that thought process. So Avraham just goes out there and saying, I can't discuss it. We're going to do something. I am proactive here. I realize this is a scenario. The people in the world that I have to deal with are rough characters, and this is the only way you got to deal with, you know, fight fire with fire. And that's what he does. He has total faith in God, and he goes out with his small army, and his strategy works beautifully, and he saves Lot. You begin to think, based on what you see in Yaakov, with the way he deals, would Yaakov have done that? Would Yaakov would choose to negotiate somehow? V'hecharish Yaakov ad bawam, he's looking for, you know, let's discuss it, let's talk about it. Yaakov doesn't go and seek out the children and say, we got to get together and do something about it. He waits for them to come home. Why was Yaakov one way and Avraham another way? Because what's in the middle between Avraham and Yaakov is Yitzchak. Now, why was Yitzchak the way he was? Well, he felt he was an Ola Tamima, and probably on some level he couldn't be proactive, because I don't know what stage of his life he became blind, but obviously that certainly put a kibosh on his ability to be proactive and fight. So while Yitzchak learned from Avraham, the fact remains that where is he going? And even if he feels that way, Avraham has achieved a certain modicum of success and stability in the family, and he could sit, not to say rest on his laurels, but he has achieved some sort of peace in his generation. And whenever he runs into trouble, since he is not, you know, he feels himself very holy because he's had the experience in life of the Akedah, changes his outlook. When he has children, Yaakov is using his father as a role model, and his father was the one who was more a peaceful person rather than the way he was. And what he learned from his father was probably to talk his way out of a situation, and he continues to be that type of a person. And he's always looking to extricate himself from every type of a problem with discussion. He's not going to use force unless it's necessary. And should, you know, children are brought up to think when we say V'yakov ishtam yoshev ho'olim, we always have to remind ourselves of some of the mefarshim point out that when it says V'yogel esu'evim me'al pi'aber, you know, Yaakov was Esav's twin brother. And therefore he was equally strong, equally capable physically, but he chose not to use his physical strength and appearance to be that type of an imposing figure and use it in that respect. He chose to be a laid-back person and only use his strength if it was absolutely necessary. And that is what he gives over to his children on some level, and perhaps there's that part of Reuven who has this thought process of not reacting and let's just, you know, do one thing. And then you have Shimon and Levi who grow up with the influence of maybe of Lavan or maybe their uncle Esav, who they see as a tough guy, and maybe that's the way to accomplish things in life. But they each have, they've heard the stories of Avraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov, and therefore they react. Each child has a different mentality, whether it's genetic or not, of course, we don't know. But basically, that's where Maaseh Avos Imo L'Banim is always a very interesting thought process, and everything always comes back to that point at that time, a point in time.
Yehuda did both.
What?
Yehuda did both.
Right. Yeah. But as we pointed out on Friday, I mean, as Rabbi Levine pointed out on Friday, Yehuda, he was a master of his speech as well. He used that part, which I use Shabbos in that point, which happened to be very appropriate because of what went on in my shul this week. We had a big blowout meeting yesterday about the anti-president and... You know, so I told the joke privately, but whatever it was, it went over big. I knew when the president was in shul, I couldn't tell, but as I thought he would, it would go over his head anyhow. That's what people agreed. What? He was looking for COVID. You know, everybody hates his guts, and you know, but a life nuchen COVID. You know, so as I heard at a bris many years ago, I heard. Two rebbes, I mean, I shouldn't say two rebbes, two chassidim at a bris by, I don't know if it was, it was at a real chassidish affair, a bris in the morning in the bungalow in the summer, and two of them were talking about their rebbes, and one said, Dan Rebbe, life duchen covered, you know, and he says, you don't understand. My rabbi, you know, I'm saying in Yiddish, but man Rebbe, life nish duchen covered, he knows that there was life nuchen covered, so life davek. And your Rebbe shuns covered, he's very humble, but that's because he knows he really wants the covered, so he acts humble because then the covered is going to come and he'll get the covered. My Rebbe really doesn't want it, knows that if he acts humble, the covered is going to come to him. So he really wants to be under this. So a life nuchen covered because he knows it's going to run away from him. And he's really, I remember hearing this conversation to which I looked at my father-in-law and said, are you listening to these two guys talking? It was hysterical. I thought it was very funny. But that's nevertheless, this was a real conversation. This wasn't a joke.
You know what the punchline is? Why doesn't he get the cook? Because he's looking afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, however you want to look at it. But so he does this. So Yaakov was well aware of the situation here. Whether Yaakov knew what happened with the Mechiris Yosef, you could look at it. But as I've mentioned in the past, if you notice, it says three times, what did Yaakov know? And if he did know, when did he find out? But you see, at the very end, you seem to think that he must have known, or at least the brothers assume that Yosef had a conversation with him. Because when they come back from the funeral, and the brothers say to Yosef, Avicha tziva lifnei moso leimar, kosom ruli Yosef. You know, tell him, Avicha tziva, you know, that's a pesha, checha v'roch, v'chatosom ki roch g'malucha, v'yatosana, l'pesha avdei avicha. And what is the end is? Vayef Yosef b'davro me'lov. the means because he was emotional? No, because I wanted to say was Vayef Yosef Vidabra Melov, because what is that telling him? He was hoping that he didn't see his brothers much in these last 17 years, but he hoped that at this point, if Yaakov knew everything, that they did a true tshuva. But why was he crying over here? What does that actually tell you when they say all of this to Yosef? He sees that, you know what? You never really understood. You don't get it. Elokim chashava letova. I was willing to forgive you with my truest, you know, from the bottom of my heart, I really forgave everybody because I understood the big picture that kila michyosh lochani Hashem lifneichem. I understand that this was all, we were all part of a grand plan here. You never got it. And if you're going to tell me these things at this point in time, you never got it either. And you still think that I was waiting like Esav said, you know, in his mom, Vayomer Esav libo, yikrevu yimei evel avi, and now that Yaakov is dead, maybe you're thinking like Esav. If you're thinking just like Esav, then you never really did tshuva in the first place. This is your mindset. You're still trying to forestall any retribution, revenge, and I truly forgave you. The question is, maybe they saw in Yaakov resentment. Maybe they saw certain things in resentment from Yaakov, which is why what I said, what I mentioned to you last week, the thought process is that when the Malchus Yisrael split between B'nai Yehuda and Binyamin and to the Aseres HaShvatim. After Shlomo, you have Rechavam as opposed to Yeravim ben Nevat. The Malchus split, they got the okay to do it. So throughout, after that point in time, B'nai Yisrael are referred to as B'nai Ephraim, as Ephraim, HaBein Yakili Ephraim, and various other phrases that we have throughout Tanakh calling the Aseres HaShvatim with the moniker of Ephraim, the title Ephraim behind. Where did that come from? Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
All right. So what is the reason that, so we know why, because the first king was from Shevet Ephraim, certainly. But what gave the koach of why was it Dafka Yeravim ben Nevat from Shevet Ephraim to bring that about? What I wanted to suggest possibly was that Menashe grew up in the palace with Yosef. Yosef understood from his father being growing up when it says, you'll do al berkei Yosef at the end of the parasha, that Menashe, gam b'nei mochir ben Menashe, you'll do al berkei Yosef. Menashe understood his father's attitude was total forgiveness, that they were all part of a grand plan. It's a wonderful thing. And he said, this is the way God worked it out. For whatever reason, he had Rachmanis on our father Yaakov, and he didn't want to bring him down in chains, and various things of that nature. And this was part of the grand plan. Ephraim was, where was he? He wasn't sitting in the palace with Yosef. Ephraim, for these 17 years, was sitting with Yaakov and learning, and that's why Yaakov saw the godless in Ephraim, that he would be this, you know, he would be the leader of the people. And Yaakov, or Ephraim, felt, even though Yaakov understood that the grand plan, the picture too, but Yaakov always resented the fact and felt it, as you see at the end with the brachas and giving Ephraim and Menashe special brachas. There was a certain level of, as a human being, you can't hide your emotions totally. He felt the resentment of Yaakov losing his pride and joy for 22 years. This person who, in his mind, was his true heir apparent. Because Yaakov, at this point in time, did not know that, according to some of Farshim, that Yaakov was bringing up Yosef after Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. You have the Avos. The next leader was, what was the big thing that made Yaakov feel V'aviv Shamaris Hadavar? What was the operative word over here? That Avraham had his visitations from God with his chalomos. Yitzchak, we, as far as we know, did not particularly, but Yaakov was the dreamer. And now Yosef, he is the dreamer. And therefore, V'aviv shamaris hadavar, he realized the attitude of the brothers. But now I am sure I gave Yosef the ksonas pasim, I give Yosef all of these special things like that. But Yosef is the next one to be the next avos number four. That Yosef is now going to carry the mantle of leadership for the future, just like Avraham, Yitzhak, and me, Yaakov. Yosef, you need to be, who is the dreamer that will be the next leader? Yosef was the dreamer. And now he carries the mantle of leadership. And he needs that upbringing the same way Avraham brought up Yitzhak. Yitzhak brought up Yaakov to some degree. Obviously, it doesn't seem to be. There was some disconnect between Yitzhak and Yaakov, certainly because he tried to develop Esav more, perhaps. But nevertheless, Yaakov is thinking along those lines. And he feels that resentment. Ephraim is beginning to feel that undercurrent of resentment and always waiting. And not only that, but when the brachas come about, and even after he gets his blessing from Yaakov, that he says, you will rise to leadership. But the end result is, Yehuda ato yoducha achecha, and that lo yosur shevet mihuda. So even if the bechor is taken away from Reuven, so, okay, so maybe it's going to follow through in Yosef. But then who does Yaakov, after all he feels this undercurrent, who does he pass the mantle of leadership to? Yehuda. He's, given another curveball over here, and he gives it to Yehuda. Yehuda toyaducha chechal yosur shevet mihuda, and now it's a whole different thing, and the resentment is passed on from generation to generation. And you don't know how long. Maisa avo simon labonim goes again, and there's always that feeling of resentment coming along one generation after another. And that's why it says, gam b'nei mochir b'menashe yul du al berkei Yosef, which in the past is why I had mentioned that pasuk, as I like to say, some psukim in the Torah or words in the Torah seem to be what I like to refer to as seemingly we have, why does it list so many words? They seem to be throwaway psukim or throwaway words, but in fact, we know that's never the case, that every word, every letter, every nekuda is there for a reason. It's not like in Navi, where the Nevi'im wrote it, God gave them license to maybe say a few words on their own. It's not like Vayedaber Shema Moshe Lemar, he said everything verbatim. The Avos had a chance to interpret their dreams, but nevertheless, they saw things on a certain level, and this is the way they saw it, but it was passed on, and the undercurrent is there for generations. Little Menashe forgave, because his father forgave, and Yosef kept saying again, V'alto al teyotzvu, three times, because he sees the feelings of his brothers. But the Abarbanel points out very interestingly, and maybe they got that feeling too, that's why they said Ovicha Tziva, because the Abarbanel says what Yosef was saying when he says V'ato al teyotzvu, doesn't say, sometimes we think of it V'ato and you, but the Ato is spelled with an ayin. Now, he's saying the Yosef is saying to brothers, yeah, don't worry, there's going to be a heavy price to pay for what you did. What you did was terrible. God will pay you back. Except for one thing, don't worry about it now. V'ato al teyotzvu. Right now, nothing's going to happen. You can relax. Which is why when Yaakov dies, when Yaakov is nifter, and they come back from the funeral, they're thinking, well, v'ato al teyotzvu, maybe though now is going to be that time. So they have that. But Yosef, Vayevki Yosef, B'davro Me Love, he sees that they never really understood everything very clearly.
Well, Yosef lived through the dreams. He lived through the experience. They didn't live through it.
No, you're right.
He knew that they
absolutely.
Ended up in it.
You're You're right. But they understood it too, because what was their attitude when they said, "V'nireh mayu chalom osav"? So they now know. In other words, they had that thought, you know, let's do what we have to do now, and then we'll see. Listen, if he survives, then we know that his dreams were heaven sent. But if he dies here, then the dreams are over, and they were the dreams of a kid who just had dreams. V'nireh mayu chalom osav. Very good. Wonderful. But now when they see that not only did he say what he said, but he actually was the king in Egypt. And what is Yosef's message is, the Abarbanel makes a very interesting point. I don't think that's the Abarbanel. I don't think this is the Abarbanel. And in one pasuk it says, "Vayisimenu li'ov lifaro li'adon l'chol beiso moshel b'chol eretz Mitzrayim." If you notice, there's three different lashonos in the same pasuk. There's of, Adon, and Moshel. In one pasuk is three different about being the leader, being in charge, and each one has a different message. Vayisimenu li'ov. People are treat lefaro. Paro treats me like his father. Sometimes you have a relationship. You have people in a family. You watch family relationships, and sometimes the mother of a child, seemingly the relationship at some point in your life turns around, and the daughter or the son becomes the parent. When the parent gets old, it's the child who becomes the parent. And Yosef was still, I don't know how old Pharaoh was at the time. I don't know at which point, you know, how old Pharaoh was. But nevertheless, he just said, "Kol asher yomru elecha," you know, whatever he says, do. He knows what he's doing. I see the hand of God. This person has Ruchni Yisavi here, he knows everything to do, which is the interesting thing over here. One thing that Rabbi Alper points out is the amazing thing is when Yosef interprets the dream, basically we know you don't speak when you're talking to a king. They give the dignitaries and how to express themselves when you're talking to a leader of another country. You don't speak, you know, everybody is given, when they go to Queen Elizabeth, they don't speak unless spoken to. You don't initiate a conversation.
Protocol.
Exactly. So Yosef is asked by Paro to interpret the dream. He interprets the dream. And then all of a sudden, when he finishes interpreting the dream, he starts to wax poetic all about the dreams. And he says, now I'm going to tell you what the dreams are, what God, the message from the dream is as follows, and this is what you should do. V'chimeshes, Eretz Mitzrayim, and all these things, you have the Yitzvubar, and all these things, you have to, the way you're going to save the world is by storing up all the excess into storehouses and various things like that. And he's speaking without any, he's not being asked to explain what he should do about it. It's up to Paro.
Was his own thoughts, or was that part of his dream?
No, that wasn't part of the dream. The dream didn't say that. The dream just was that there's going to be 7 years of famine, 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And the reason that the dreams were back-to-back was to show that it's going to happen forthwith, that they're going to happen right away. It's not as if it's going to happen sometime in the future. It's going to begin immediately. V'al hishonos hachalom el paro pamoyim. That's it. It's going to happen. Start. Well, he understands because Yosef has had his experience with dreams. But what Rabbi Alpert points out is, what was the reason that Yosef at this juncture begins to explain the dreams to Paro, what he now has to do, what action he has to take, and the way it's going to help the country? Because he realizes, as the Abarbanel says here also, not Rabbi Alpert, when it says, "Vayehi mikeitz nosayim yomim," Yosef wasn't punished because he put his faith in the Sarah Mashke. He needed to tell Paro, he needed to languish in the jail 2 more years because timing is everything. He had to be in jail so that when it came time to interpret Paro's dream, they knew where to find Yosef. If Yosef had been let out of jail 2 years earlier, who knows where he'd be? Okay, and when Paro has his dream, Well, true enough, but this is timing here. This is when Bnei Yisrael are supposed to start their galus. You're right. But obviously timing, that's the point. The galus, God has a time schedule for everything. And for it to work out the way it has to, he had to be there and be available and show and let Yosef experience the fact that from the dungeon, he is on the throne in a minute later. All of a sudden. But Yosef knows it's on top of everything because he had to be there. What did he learn in those 2 years? Who is he in jail with at this point? What takes him out of prison? The dream that he interprets for the Sara Mashke and the Sara Ofer. These people that he was in jail with, the Sara Mashke and the Sara Ofer, were dealing with, there were four people in those dreams when it says Chatu Mashke Melech Mitzrayim Ofer, which is more than one parish says on it, that there are four people involved in this scenario. There's the Sara Mashke and there's the Mashke. There's the Sara Ofer and the Ofer. This Sara Mashke and the Sara Ofer weren't the ones who committed the act of seeming what you want to call treason by letting Paro have whatever was in the piece of wood or a pebble in the bread and the wine with the fly in it. That wasn't the sin. It wasn't for the Sara Mashke. It says, Chotu Mashke Melech Mitzrayim. One of the bakers who served Paro, one of the wine stewards who served Paro, they gave the wine cup. The overlord, the Sara Mashke, the Sara Ofer, let it happen. So who gets punished is the person in charge. You don't go to the underling. Where did the problem begin? The problem began with the Sara Mashke, the Sara Ofer. They should have known one thing. Anybody, the Sara Mashke, the Sara Ofer, I understand you want to serve all the other politicians, all the other dignitaries in the palace. You could send one of your underlings to bring his bread, to bring his coast. That's fine. The king? I'm worth it to do it yourself. So how does the story end at that point with the Sara Mashke when they give over their dream? They're telling them, when it says, Vayisaw Esro Sara Mashkim Vyesro Sara Ofer Besochavodav, he gave them both back their jobs after the Yom Huledes Esparo. They each got their jobs back. And now he watched how they acted. And now when Paro wanted to have his cake and eat it, so to speak, or his bread, and the Sara Mashke wanted his cup of wine, Paro was watching. The Sara Mashke went and said, wait a minute, I'm bringing the coast to the king myself. The Sara Ofer brought, said to the guy, said to his underling, the Ofer, bring the king his bread. And Paro says, you didn't learn your lesson. He did, and you didn't. I see, this is the mistake. He understood that Paro gets private service from the chief. The Sara Ofer sent once again the underling. What was the godless of the dream, the interpretation was? Because on the surface, it would certainly seem who should be the one that's killed and who should be the survivor under normal circumstances. To take a look at a cup of wine and see that there's a fly in it, the naked eye tells you. So the person who serves the king, all he had to do was look at the cup. To be a pebble buried in the bread, you expect him to rip apart every loaf of bread, to take apart every little thing, that's more difficult. So the rational explanation would be to let the Sara Ofer give him the pass, and the Sara Mashke is the one that's really at fault, but Yosef's interpretation went against the grain. And that's why Paro concocted this scenario to see at least who learns his lesson from the experience. And it was the Sara Hamashke who learned his lesson from the experience. And he said, you have your job back, your life is over. And that's the way it goes. Yosef, but while he's languishing in jail with these two people, the Sara Mashke and the Sara Ofer are in control of the economy of Egypt. They learn all about the grain. when you get the bread, the winter wheat, the summer wheat, various things, what I need for baking. He is in charge. He's the Sara Mashke, the Sara Ofer. They learn all about the growing of the grapes, the good wine, the bad wine, the cheap wine, the whatever it is. And he knows. And now Yosef, when he's interpreting Paro's dream, all of a sudden he has that epiphany. And he waxes poetic. And he says, I know right now why I was with the Sara Ofer and the Sara Mashke. He couldn't hold himself back. As soon as he is interpreting the dream, he says, I got it. I now understand everything, why I was in jail with the Sara Mashke and the Sara Ofer. It wasn't happenstance. God didn't do this to me for no reason. I see. This is why I say that Yosef was the singular in one thing. He knew he could put his finger on every day of his life why God made it happen to him. From the day he started having his dreams, by the time he's 56, he understands every occurrence in his life. How many people could say that? I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to understand things. Hareini noes kvodecha. He didn't understand certain things, and he certainly had a greater intellect than anybody who ever lived. But nevertheless, he was still trying to figure out where things were going. Yosef understood clearly he's a pawn, God has a plan, and I've seen everything come to fruition from the time I start having my dreams till now. I got it all. I've seen it all. And I understand every act of God in the lifespan that I've experienced. I know why it happened. And he treats his life accordingly and lives that life. That he realizes God is in total control. Of course, his mistake was, as some of Farshim point out at the end of the parsha, is when Yosef says, I am the breadwinner here, I am Vayachalkel Yosef, and he starts to treat everybody, and the Lashon is, and I will feed you all. I will take care of everybody. Oh, really, God says to him? So what's the next pasuk? Vayamas Yosef. He says, you know what? You've outlived your usefulness. And basically, that's how the parsha begins. Vayechi Yosef b'Eretz Mitzrayim shva esrei shana. So they dash in the word Vayechi, that he began to look beyond. The fact is, he longed so much to live in Eretz Yisrael. Did not look forward. He wanted to go visit Yosef. He didn't want to be there forever. But when God tells him in the dream, Yosef, Yoshis Yodo Aleinecho, okay. So God tells him, so of course he listens. But God says, I didn't tell you, you had to enjoy it. Vayechi Yaakov, Bi'eretz Mitzrayim, I lived. I didn't exist. He began to really enjoy his life. Oh, Vayamos, now it says, it's time, you know what, Yaakov, if you are having this mindset that you're really enjoying life here, then you're giving over that attitude to your children that you could enjoy life in Golus, it's time for you to go. And now I want to let my children and grandchildren experience the tzoras that we say, Nistamu Einayim Shel Yisrael, is that not B'nai Yisrael, but Yaakov lost his vision of the future, of that this is a bad thing. I want you to experience not the good life in Golus. I want you to always feel to go back. I want you to always feel that way, which is why Yosef passed that on to his children, which is why I say, Gam b'nei mochir b'menashe, you'll do al birkei Yosef. So when it says later on in Pinchas, and when it says in Pinchas, b'nei menashe ben Yosef, by b'nos slavcha, ben mochir b'menashe, Ben Yosef, Lemishbechos, Menashe Ben Yosef. Why does it say that? Because Yosef said, what did he give his tzavot to Bnei Yisrael? I need you. I don't want you to wait. You know, you'll go into Eretz Yisrael, and then you'll come back for my bones. You know, listen, I'll come back. We'll send people back. And after you bring me to Eretz Yisrael, after you get settled in Eretz Yisrael, you'll come back, dig up my bones, and you'll bring me to the land, and you'll, you know, then he says, no. The second you leave, whenever that is, the second you leave Golas, the second you leave Mitzrayim, make sure you don't take a step without me. I want my bones out of here. I was denied for so many years the life in Eretz Yisrael. I want you, no matter what it takes, I want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Where did that come from? He had that feeling. B'nai Yisrael carried his bones. He had the schus for them to schlep along his sarcophagus, whatever it was at that point in time already, just a bag of bones. If it was what they did was sarcophagus is they take the remains of the body and put it in a little box, so to speak, and they carried it along with them. There's a machlokas about the rest of the Shvatim if they did that with them as well. They say, some say yes, some say no. But nevertheless, Yosef expressed that feeling. B'nei Mochir Ben Menasheh, where did B'nai Slavkot come from? That line that Yuldu al Birkei Gam B'nei Mochir Ben Menasheh, Yuldu al Birkei Yosef. Because Yosef, that attitude that was passed on from Yosef to B'nai Mochir ben Menasheh, so when it says, L'mishpachos Menasheh ben Yosef, B'nai Mochir ben Menasheh, was passed on, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, were brought up at the feet of Yosef. Eretz Yisrael at all costs. All costs. I don't want any excuses. The minute we leave, take me with you. Don't come back for me later. I understand you'll come back for me later. I trust you. But I don't want to be there for 1 second longer than I have to be. Take me immediately. So that's why the Gemara says that what was the reason that Moshe didn't have the schus to at least be buried in Eretz Yisrael? Because when it says in next week's parsha, not this week's parsha, but next week's parsha, Yisro says to his daughters, what was going on today? And they say, Ish Mitzri, Hitzilano Miyad Haroim. Moshe doesn't protest. Lets himself be called an Ish Mitzri. And doesn't protest as Yosef was always referred to. He wore his religion on his sleeve and let the chips fall where they may. He never held back. Yosef didn't look for excuses, so to speak. He wasn't parsing his words. Whatever happened, he said it outright. And I'm running out of thoughts because I'm talking as I speak. My mind is running with the next thought to continue. But so that's the thought process. I don't know where from the last year what I said before and what I said after. So whatever it is, anybody have any questions? And that'll trigger some other thoughts. So if you have any other thoughts, I'm just giving you one complete scenario over here.
You have mentioned, until Paro was alive, he was second command. But you said later on, ultimately, he became the
king. Yeah. At one point I said, historically speaking, there's a lag time because what the historians, they don't have a missing piece of history in Egyptian culture. I went to an exhibit on Tutankhamun, and I started to make a chart of time frame, which you can't trust exactly. But still in all, there is a lag, and Abba Ibn wrote it in the Apocrypha he wrote in his book years ago about Egyptian history. He focused on that too. And there's a lag time, I mean, it's a part of history in Egyptian history that seems to be wiped. And they don't seem to know. But what they do know in history, that this one pharaoh, it seems to be, that was believed in monotheism. They're aware of the fact, and they don't know who this is, but he was king for a long time. And let's face it, Yosef lived till 110. He was V'Yosef ben Shloshim Shana B'Yomdo Lifnei Paro Melech Mitzrayim. So you have to realize 80 years he was on the throne as Pharaoh, as viceroy, second in command, or king, whatever it is. Some commentaries say that this Yosef was eventually, when Pharaoh died, instead of appointing a new Pharaoh, he ascended the throne as the Pharaoh instead. Yeah. Because Pharaohs were not, it wasn't like from David HaMelech become Shlomo. Pharaohs were not father to son. Pharaohs was a power struggle. And that's what it was every time. It was rarely, when you see the Valley of the Kings, when they list, they have a listing of all the pharaohs, what they in secular historical records of time frame, there is a lot of time that's unaccounted for. And it's easy, and strangely enough, there's a 200-year period that is totally unaccounted for in Egyptian history. And it fits in perfectly, dating-wise, with the time that the Jews were in Mitzrayim, because this, they patently want to wipe away from the history because it doesn't reflect well on Egypt as a country, basically, and it's just seemingly they wiped it off their and they don't know. So I saw recently a whole thing I was reading, and I saw, you know, in reference to that, in the Valley of the Kings, they are trying to piece together the missing history pieces by looking up some pharaohs, and they now have found some new tombs that are unmarked. But obviously, it was royalty that were buried, but not with the same trappings, because when it says, Vayomas Melech Mitzrayim, Vayanchu B'nei Yisrael Manavodo, who was that? Because it seems to be, at this point in time, a short period of time, from the time Vayomas Melech Mitzrayim until the Geula began to come to fruition. And if you do a dating period, as I made a chart from what they give their dates to our dating system, from things like that, and it seems to be a short space of time, that is what comes out to Tutankhamun, who died at 16 or 18 years old from some genetic disease. He had either some genetic bone disease. They thought at one point he was poisoned. They thought at one point he had an accident falling off a horse. They speculate a lot of things. They're not really 100% sure. He broke his leg and he didn't recover it. But what comes to be that is that triggered he had a bone disease and that he died young because he had some sort of problem, which they... Why do they speculate that? Because there was a lot of intermarriage in terms of, you know, relatives marrying relatives, and that in actuality, they now say that who was Tutankhamun's wife? His sister. That was what the kicker at the end of the show was, that they did the DNA, DNA of Tutankhamun, and they found a, because usually the queens would be... and it was buried without trappings. They found a grave, and they did some DNA, and the DNA of Tutankhamun and this woman that was buried without trappings was the same DNA, which would mean it's not a mother and a son, but they have markers. They tell you there's X amount of markers that tell you how close people were in a relationship. And when you get beyond... 4, it says, you know, you're a cousin. When you get 8 markers, you could be, you know, mother, you know, father and son, mother and daughter, or whatever it is, brother and sister. And it would seem to be that Tutankhamun's wife was his sister, and this was, and the grave, they didn't like it at that point, whatever it is, and she was buried in an unmarked grave. It's just... That was the last 5 minutes. That's what they were getting up to say what they now found. And but why did he die? Was he murdered? Was he not? But the fact is that Yosef was on the throne, seemingly by all accounts, for many years on his own. And that would account for the fact that this pharaoh believed in, there was this pharaoh who had this belief in one God, and promulgated, so when things changed, that they forgot Yosef, when it says, when they Asher lo yodas Yosef, there was always a power struggle, that every pharaoh, as it says in all these exhibits, every pharaoh, it's like, you know, in sports, you hire a new coach, you hire a new manager, he brings in his team of managers and coaches for all his other things, every Pharaoh, literally speaking, brought in his own team of gods. And they were like the ones who had their name Ra, they were believed in the sun, and every name is synonymous with what they got. Each Pharaoh had a name, some were, you know, other. And of course, as I said 20 years ago one time when I was speaking someplace else, it seemed to me, and now I was laughing, I said to Rifki, I said to my wife, that you see, look at that, they actually picked up on it. And on the show they mentioned that Pharaoh's Bas Paro, her father's name was Moses. And when she named Moshe, I said it came to me that her father was named, you know, I forgot the beginnings of the name, but the last part of his name was Moses. And that was Tutmosis. Yes, Tutmosis. And so when she says that they called him Vayikra Shmo Moshe, they said, and possibly that's why she named him Moshe. This was a secular show. It had nothing to do with religion. And I made that correlation many years ago when I was going through a museum and saying, very interesting, because there were two pharaohs with the moniker Moses on it. And she was trying to, you know, bring him up as the next pharaoh. And possibly that would happen. But Moshe, of course, was a different type of person. Any other questions?
Yeah. When did Yaakov know, and when did he know it?
It's a machlokas. This was a running argument I had with my father over years. My father always took the track of the father, and I always took the track of the son. Like with Dina, I said, you know, my father would always yell that Yaakov was right, and I always said the brothers were right, and we had this ongoing argument for years.
We were at the Yaguna convention, and at the Shabbos table, somebody posed that question, that did a survey around the table. Who was right, Yaakov or the brothers?
Well, the story seems to indicate my take on what Icon said to my father. God gives the last line in the story how he feels. And the last line in the story is Vayomru, Hakzono Yaseh Tzachosenu, touch a Jew, there's a price to pay. You want Hakzono Yaseh Tzachosenu, and he says, that's the end of it. I want you to value this situation here more. The same way at the Egel. And what is the last line in the Egel? Asher Oso Aaron. So we know what happened. What was the reason? Because there was payback. Listen, you made your a gadol. You had the future of Klal Yisrael in your hands. You could have forestalled it. Maybe you didn't want to risk your life the way, because Chur died, and now you saw the aftermath of what happened to Chur. As Rabbi Schwab points out in his Sefer, he knew, Aaron knew, that if he would sacrifice his life, there would be no coming back from that. God would not forgive Klal Yisrael if they Aaron was not willing to make the sacrifice, not because he wasn't willing to die for it, but he wasn't willing. He realized that if they would kill him while he was willing to make the sacrifice, if Aaron would be killed, there would be no forgiveness ever, because Aaron was too great. It was tantamount to, you know, horror, okay. But to kill Aaron, who was a Oev Yisrael, a Rodev Shalom, by all accounts, we know so much. If they killed him, they crossed the Rubicon. And that's the end of everything now. There's no coming back. So that was, in other words, he was Mosa Nefesh in that respect. And that was Aaron's attitude. But the aftermath of that is that since Moshe was initially, he says, but he gets into this in Pinchas, the aftermath of that is that Aaron was, I mean, by when Moshe hits the rock, the reason he goes all the way back to the Egel as the catalyst for the events that took place, because he said initially Moshe was supposed to be the Kohen Gadol, Aaron never was going to be in the picture at all, because V'aron Achicha Yeh Nevi'echa wasn't part of the original plan. And therefore, the way it happened was, this happened the way it, you know, this all took, you know, one evently, he pieces together events that says that Moshe never would have come to hit the rock if it weren't for Aaron's story with the Egel. Because what happened with when after the Egel, Moshe chides Aaron, gives him tochacha, and the Torah puts it in his lap, and he loses his sons, and Aaron understands, Vayidom Aaron, when he's silent, because he realizes that there was a price to pay for what he did, and he lost Nadav and Reu. Being a Navi, he, I mean, not necessarily, you only understand what God lets you understand or see, but he pieced together, he was able to put two and two together, that he lost his two children, maybe this was payback for what he did, he made the wrong decision at the time, but the reality was, when Moshe, what was the reason that Aaron had to suffer for hitting the rock? How come Aaron lost his ability to go into Eretz Yisrael because Moshe hit the rock? Why should you punish Aaron? It says, what? Vayach es hasela b'mateyu pa'moyim. After he hit the rock the first time, should have stopped him before he hit it the second time. So Moshe was responsible for strike number one. But strike two was on Moshe's cheshbon. I mean, on Aaron's cheshbon. This is Rabbi Schwab. It's on his cheshbon. He should have stopped him after he hit it the first time. He said, Moshe, what are you doing? God said to both of us. In the parsha, you see, it says God spoke to Moshe and Aaron. Talk to the rock. He didn't just talk to Moshe. It says, take a look, and it says he spoke to Moshe and Aaron and told them both. Aaron also heard the tzivui. And he didn't stop Moshe after the first one. Now this is on your cheshbon. You didn't stop your brother from hitting the rock the second time. Now this is the price to pay for you too. But so then why was when at the end, the Abarbanel makes an interesting point in Zos HaBrocha and says that Moshe at least, when he Alei Rosh HaPiskah, and take a look, and you'll see Yom of a Cave, the phone of an egg, but take a look at Eretz Yisrael, go up to the top of the mountain. Aaron didn't even get the ability to see Eretz Yisrael from a distance. Aaron didn't even get that much. Why not? Because Moshe's sin was Vayaches Asela. Yan lo emantem bi lahagdi sheni. Aaron's sin was equal, except for one thing. He also had strike two with the Egel. He had the Egel, so that lost him the ability to even see from afar to see. Was he able to see the whole? Moshe was told to go up on the mountain two different times in the end. Take a look, right? And so sorry, it says in the end, go up on the mountain, Alei Rosh HaPiskah. And then it says again later on, Alei, go up and take a look, Reyes Oretz. There's a difference between the first and second time. The first time he goes up to the mountain, you go up and you stand on, you know, you look, if you're in the Northeast or you're in the Rockies, whatever it is, you take a look from Mount Washington when you climb Mount Washington and you look at the whole scenario, you're only 6,000 feet up in the air and you get a pretty good view. But you can't really see everything well unless you're using the spy glasses that they have over there, you put in a quarter and you get to see. By the way, on the West Coast, when you go up to the mountaintops at 11 and 12,000 feet in the Rockies, in the Canadian Rockies, they have those same things. They're free. You don't have to put in a quarter in a machine. They're all over the place for nothing. So you get to look around. You're 11,000 feet and you see all the other peaks. It's a beautiful sight. But you don't have supervision. You don't really see the land. He says, the Abarbanel makes a point of saying, when God told him the second time to go up in the mountain, the first time he saw it as a normal person would see, his eye, his vision. The second time was the way, if you look into the way the words are formulated there, you could now you see this, you see this, you see this. God gave him at that moment supervision to really see the land totally, to see not 20 miles, because your eyes don't see beyond the horizon, but he gave Moshe the ability to see, to really get a bird's eye view By the way, why is that expression a bird's eye view? Because birds have supervision. They don't have eyes like we have. Eagles see things magnified 20 times. They could see a worm from 200 feet in the air. They could see a worm on the ground and dive right to get their prey at unheard of speeds of 200 miles an hour to fly, because they see things from that distance, from way up in the sky. They could see a little animal sticking his head out of the ground, and in 3-4 seconds, they could grab it. It's unbelievable.
It was a show where they had a falcon trainer.
Right.
They put him a mile away, and the bird saw the trainer from a mile away and zoomed right at him.
Yes.
From a mile away, he saw.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, middle of the mountain.
But you see, here I was, you know, I'm sitting here and talking. And the truth is, my wife asked me to do something this morning, and I said, and she wanted me to go early in the morning, and I was waffling. I turned my car, and I was about to go, and I said, no, I'll go after, or maybe tomorrow, or whatever it is. So I came. So I was, that's my first thought was, you see, I came for the right reason.
You want another question?
I think by listening to the
sweetest
of your Torah, I feel my voice has come back partially. I think maybe I don't
want to
waste the day.
Maybe, Rabbi, maybe you could help me out over here. My voice is going hoarse. If maybe you could help me out for the last hour, no, I would appreciate it if you're able.
A very special day of test. Maybe a short break.
Yeah.
And then, as long as my voice can carry, I want to discuss a few ideas relating to the significance of today. Rabbi Mayevsky, it is amazing how you, on the moment's notice, can give such a thing. I've never seen anything like this.
Thank you. Yeah, oh, yeah, wonderful.